Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It has been one of my great privileges to get to know a man of uncommon intelligence who has been working in a variety of different capacities, including in the service of his country in uniform, against our enemies in this war for the free world. He is these days a brigadier general, as a matter of fact, in the United States Army Reserves, as well as a sitting member of Congress representing the people of the 4th District of Pennsylvania. He serves on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, its Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, but perhaps most importantly on its Homeland Security Committee, where he serves as the chairman of its Subcommittee on Oversight. He is Representative Scott Perry, and we are delighted to have him back with us, sir. Thank you very much for taking a few minutes to join us.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Look, we're faced today again with another outrage in the form of a violent jihadist attack in Europe. It has involved the beheading of a priest in the middle of serving mass. Would you talk a little bit about how this part of the war for the free world is going, Congressman Perry? Doesn't seem well.
Well, I don't think we're doing a very good job at it, and one might say that the West doesn't have their mind wrapped around this new type of warfare, nonlinear warfare, where in the West, generally speaking, the enemy was on one side of the line, and the friendlies were on the other side of the line, and now we haven't fully come to realize that the enemy takes a different complexity now, and that they walk among us in too many occasions. But I think there's something more, sir, than that. I think that there's some refusal, for whatever reason, and we can go through the, you know, we talked at length about some of the rationale, but there's a refusal to acknowledge what is this enemy and how they operate. And this happened, as I understand it, in Normandy, France. Hostages taken, and Allahu Akbar being yelled as they beheaded an 86-year-old priest. That's not something that they want to be shocking. That's part of this. That's part of the tactics, the techniques, and the procedures of ISIS in particular, and maybe in some people would reference the Quran regarding those tactics. But you know, we're told, well, no, this is extremism. This is gun control. And of course, the gun didn't remove the priest's head. As a matter of fact, I understand also there was a knife attack in Japan today that killed scores of people.
And there've been axes, and there've been trucks, and there've been bombs of various kinds. No, this is not a gun control problem.
Yeah. It's the methodology is what we seem to focus on for the attack, as opposed to the deeper meaning and the deeper strategy, and because I guess it's too uncomfortable to talk about.
Yeah, Congressman, let me ask you about that, because I think that's, you're really getting to the nub of the issue here. What we're focusing on, it seems as though in this country and in Europe as well, we've typically been trying to do sort of postmortems on attacks rather than a comprehensive job of preventing the attacks from occurring in the first place. And your counterpart over in the Senate side, Senator Ted Cruz, chairing the Oversight Subcommittee, in his case of the Judiciary Committee, has recently held a hearing on willful blindness on the part of government that has, I guess, in a way, translated what you've just been describing into a failure of policy. How do you see that, and what can be done about it?
Well, I see it quite the way that you do, and if you watch the Senate hearings, it should be apparent to you that there is an aversion to get to the nub of the issue, to the very core and the center of gravity of the whole thing, and for different reasons. And I know that we're looking to do a hearing in the House Homeland Subcommittee, a similar hearing, to just follow up on it, you know, because we had moved legislation in the House regarding countering violent extremism, which it didn't start out that way, but it was pulled that way by the left because they consider the extremism where beheading a priest, they conflate that or they equate that to the same as, I think in some cases, hoisting a rebel flag in front of your house or whatever and saying that you don't like being taxed by the American government. They think those are of the same, you know, on the same level. And as long as you're going to view those things and give them the same matter of import, you are going to miss the bigger point, obviously.
Let me ask you about one piece of this, which seems to be sort of a recurring problem, whether it's the infrastructure that's being built in not just Europe, but here as well, mosques that, promote Sharia and promote jihad, Islamic societies, cultural centers and the like on the one hand, and indeed this so-called countering violent extremism project with the kind of deflection that you've just talked about, which clearly has been influenced by the Muslim Brotherhood as well. There is legislation, as you know, Congressman Scott Perry, to designate the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization. How important would that be, do you think, to both clarity as to the nature of this problem and beginning to help address it?
Well, I think that's incredibly important. When you have folks that belong to that organization being invited to the centers of power and weighing in on policy, exactly, that adds a validity to their claims and to the things that they think are important, a validity that is certainly not warranted whatsoever or justified in any way. And it tells everybody that it identifies for everybody that this is a component of the enemy. This is part of the enemy, and it might not be the enemy that's pulling out an AK-47 or a long knife but still there's an organization about every enemy, whether it's the one pulling the trigger or whether it's the one drawing up the plans and the orders. And that needs to be identified very plainly and clearly so people can see it for what it is and be aware of it. And then obviously the invites and the input from those individuals belonging to those organizations will no longer be in vogue, which is incredibly important. You can't invite the enemy into your planning cell, into your operations center, and expect any success on your behalf.
Talk a little bit, if you would, about this Iran deal President Obama struck about a year ago now, and what you make of what's happened to our understanding of that deal and the threat from Iran in the interval.
Well, we certainly can't discount the recent revelations from the administration secret transcript, so to speak, or communication, or the Ben Rhodes revelation in the New York Times magazine article. We can't discount any of that, but in a greater sense, Frank, we often say that we often use this frame, this phrase, those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Yet it seems to me that while we're saying it, we're actually doing it. And I think back to the time of Neville Chamberlain and all the other appeasers while Hitler was marching across or starting to march across Europe, beginning in Poland. This is of the same level of disregard, and it's actually more in the sense of dilatory or just immense irresponsibility. And
malfeasance
and
is the term that comes to my mind. Yeah,
there's so many ways to describe it. You can't get them all out fast enough, and that's what I struggle with. But it isn't. Hitler was invading Czechoslovakia. Hitler was invading Poland. This is going to give Iran the ability, from a nuclear standpoint, to touch every portion of the globe. It's not just their neighboring country that they share a border with. This is every single point on the planet where they're going to be able to project power in the most horrific and terrifying way. And not only did we somewhat allow it, we're actually facilitating it.
Congressman, this is a subject for a much longer conversation. I particularly salute you for the work you've been doing. Hope you'll keep that up and come back to us again soon to talk more about it, if you would. In the meantime, thanks for the work you do in the United States Congress. Godspeed, sir. Next up, Dr. David Adesnik on more unilateral nuclear disarmament from the Obama administration. It's closing days in office. What it might mean for you. Straight in.
Visit us at Facebook.com/SecureFreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, I'm Tim McGraw. The men and women of the Air Force Reserve play a vital role in protecting us at home and abroad. They are your neighbors, whose dedication to our country and commitment to their communities call them to serve. Dedication, commitment, and service. It happens every day at home and around the world. They're your neighbors, making a difference.
Joel Klein catches a 7 o'clock train after his evening CPR class at the American Red Cross.
Ron Garrity's on the same train. He's had a rough day and doesn't feel like himself. Until he feels the sudden tightness in his chest, Ron never thought he'd actually have a heart attack.
Until Joel is administering CPR, he never thought he'd actually save a life.
When you train with the Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn about life-changing opportunities in your area.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by Stephen Coughlin, one of my personal heroes, a man who has served his country with great distinction, both in the United States Army as an intelligence specialist and in a variety of capacities since leaving the United States military. He was in the Pentagon in the aftermath of 9/11 and played a very important role in some of the early thinking about the war we were in, and has contributed mightily subsequently with his company Unconstrained Analytics, and also as a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, to the policy debate. Catastrophic Failure is the title of his masterpiece on the subject. He is also a major contributor to the book that the Center put out some years ago now, Sharia, the Threat to America. You can find many of Steve's excellent videos and other instruments of pedagogy at the Center for Security Policy's website. Steve, it is always good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, I wanted to drill down on a conversation you have not had a chance to hear, but that I just had with Congressman Scott Perry, the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee's Oversight Subcommittee, about this phenomenon of willful blindness. I mean, you've spent an enormous amount of time both contending with it and warning of it. Give us your sort of working definition of what it is as it relates to this sort of global jihad and what its implications are.
Well, I think when we talk about willful blindness, I think what we have to do is stop and think about how the very way we talk about the war on terror, both in the media and in the national security space, is false. Think about this. The first thing we do when we see a terrorist event, whether it's San Bernardino, whether it's Orlando, or what we're seeing in Paris, is we come up with this false narrative. What does the news chatter about? They chatter about whether it was a lone wolf actor or... And the whole language changes to the language of the academics to talk about some kind of theory of terrorism. And what you see is the whole language of the events that actually happened. Take a look at Orlando. ISIS called for jihad. Al-Qaeda and Inspire called for jihad in May. They both did. A man acted in Orlando. He said he was acting on behalf of ISIS in exactly the way Inspire magazine says he's supposed to act.
And Steve Coughlin, pulling together the various strands of what we know took place in Orlando, and yet the bottom line still seems to be that the government can't figure out what the motive was of this shooter.
Well, I think what happened is this man went out and acted exactly according to what ISIS demanded, exactly in line with Inspire magazine, so much so that a couple weeks later, Inspire came out with an after-action report on what went right and what went wrong. So we know this was an Al-Qaeda-trained, ISIS-inspired attack. And yet the media and our national security people talk about it in abstract languages that makes you think that there are many other ways. So I think that what is willful blindness? It is the institutionalized decision to trade out language that actually defines the events with a fictitious language so they can pretend to be telling you what happened when in fact it's a charade. Because those people in our government are sworn to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies. When they trade out the language that defines the enemy in fact with these political science or psychosocial models, they have traded out their oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies with a language created by the Countering Violent Extremism narrative, the CVE, that allows them to pretend to the American people that they're doing something when they're not.
You were, of course, one of the people inside the Pentagon at the time who was counseling against this kind of approach. In fact, rather vociferously warning that this way led to disaster. You were purged from the Defense Department, as were a number of other people who were involved in similar kinds of efforts and training in particular. Describe what happened there, Steve, and how that has contributed to this now rampant problem of willful blindness.
Well, I will tell you, the way it happened the first time in 2008, I was away on vacation for Christmas with my family, and I got called because this guy named Bill Gertz wrote an article saying I was going to be fired. At all times in 2008, the way I found out about what was going on was reading the newspapers. Why is it important? Because again, when I was purged again in 2011, it was finding out what happened. They could not defeat what we were saying in fact. They knew that we were right and that we were answering the question.
So what happened is, in the first time, you had somebody named Hisham Islam on the Deputy Secretary of Defense's staff come back and get me fired. And then when I was associated with the Irregular Warfare Support Program, you had somebody very high up in the SOLIC, Special Operations Low Intensity Conflict, go around and say, this guy cannot be on contracts. By the way, that's illegal. And it all happened in both instances. That happened in a way that I was never challenged on the facts of what I said, because, of course, I can put people to sleep. And I know this is the hard reality of some of the stuff I do. I'm just weighting them down with the facts that can't be controverted. So this whole purge, which is part of the CVE, for the language of the violent extremism narrative work, they have to destroy the information and the people who put out the factual reality. So we were never given any due process.
And Steve Coughlin, I guess that's really what I want to get at here. You are not alone. There were a number of people. We've talked with several of them in the recent past, including Phil Haney from the Department of Homeland Security and Rich Higgins, who worked with you at the Defense Department, and others. And Steve, what I guess I'm really trying to make sure our audience understands, and that Congressman Perry has indicated he intends to hold a hearing on, is the cumulative effect of this failure to understand the nature of the enemy, to recognize what animates it. You've taught me it's Sharia, dooms us to an inability to provide a sensible, effective strategy for contending with these threats, right?
Absolutely. The seminal document of the Muslim Brotherhood in America that was written in 1991 specifically states that they seek to defeat America by penetrating our lines of the main lines of operation in America, to penetrate our government, to penetrate our media, to penetrate education and the religious institutions, and once penetrated, to subvert them, and subvert them so effectively they get us to subvert us by our own hand. And I want the people to understand the CVE is that main device. And I think it's really important to understand that that's the role going on with this.
And that's in part, Steve, as I understand it, because this countering violent extremism program not only involves the Muslim Brotherhood and its operatives at various levels of you know, government councils.
If we go back to 2011, the Muslim Brotherhood couldn't take down Mubarak in Egypt. They couldn't take down Gaddafi. They couldn't take down the Algerian government. They needed us to do it. So in penetrating us, they got us to do their dirty work and then get the Muslim world to hate us for doing it and allow them to fill the vacuum. I think it's very important to understand that at all times, whether it's through the OIC internationally, the Brotherhood domestically, the goal of the people who would seek the destruction of America recognized they could never defeat us in the field of battle. So at all times, the main effort was ideological subversion, and they have masterfully succeeded at that. And you see the next terrorist attack, and all the news spokespeople are fumbling over whether it is a lone wolf or whether it is a self-motivated terrorist. You see them fighting to affix and affirm and stamp that of that CVE language, even going back to Orlando, even in a situation where the actor spoke for himself with the player's defined mission.
Yeah, it's a travesty, and I think really malfeasant, as we talked about with Congressman Perry. Thank you so much, Steve, for all of your work, including that you do with us week in and week out. We really are grateful for it, and hope that you'll keep it up and come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Seth Cropsey about, among other things, what's happening in the South China Sea that might well portend conflict and worse for us. Adam Morsley.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs, like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. If you see one movie this year, make it Hillary's America. You will surely come away convinced to do everything you can to prevent this country from actually becoming hers. This film is the third by visionary political philosopher, author, and activist Dinesh D'Souza to illuminate, expose, and irradiate those seeking to fundamentally transform the United States. Hillary's America recounts the historical role played to that end by the Democratic Party. Its dramatic reenactments of odious chapters in the party's past, incisive interviews critiquing the Obama present, and D'Souza's own compelling experiences and narration powerfully warning about a dark future under Hillary Clinton make this film required viewing for every voter this fall. Opening just as Democrats began their appalling spectacle in Philadelphia, Hillary's America underscores the truly enormous stakes associated with election 2016. Please don't just see it, promote it. This is Frank Affney.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realized their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by Secretary Seth Cropsey. He served in a number of different senior-level positions in the Department of Defense. He was, among other things, an assistant to the Secretary of Defense, under whom I had the privilege of serving, Caspar Weinberger. He was also a deputy undersecretary of the Navy in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. He has been involved in a number of other capacities, including at the Voice of America and the International Broadcasting Bureau. These days, we catch up with him as a senior fellow and the director of the Center for American Sea Power at the highly regarded Hudson Institute. Mr. Secretary, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, there's so much to visit with you about, Seth. Your book, Mayday, about the condition of the United States Navy is very much on my mind. I want to start, though, by talking about one of the places, and there are many, as you've pointed out in a recent terrific piece about Jutland and some of the lessons of that famous sea battle of World War I, in which we need to be able to be present and to project power. But let me start with the South China Sea and what you make of what the Chinese are doing in response to this recent decision of the so-called arbitration panel of the Law of the Sea Tribunal, and where you think our allies and we stand there at the moment.
Well, the Permanent Court of Arbitration at The Hague ruled in favor of the Philippines in a suit that the Philippines brought in order to protect their economic rights and their territorial rights in the South China Sea, most of which China claims. One of the ways that China has been asserting that claim is by building islands, so-called man-made islands. And the Hague Court found that there was no basis on which one could say, the Chinese or anybody could say, that those islands fit the requirements under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which China has used to generate a 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone for China. And it's particularly important ruling because China ratified the Law of the Sea Treaty and is a signatory to it. The Chinese reaction, the foreign ministry has said that they don't accept it, they don't recognize the decision. They say the decision is political and has no, and is to be disregarded because it's not meant to create peace, and so on and so on.
Seth Cropsey, what does that portend? That the Chinese, as I understand it, are signaling that if we persist in the kind of behavior we've engaged in, sort of to flout their self-declared zones, namely these freedom of navigation exercises, that disaster could ensue. Do you think that likely, and are we ready?
Yeah, I think the disaster is American foreign policy toward China over the past 25 or 30 years, which has been based more than anything else on the hope, the expectation that China could be brought along as a so-called international stakeholder, that it would accept and observe the norms of international behavior and abide by the agreements that it made. And this decision by The Hague and China's outright dismissal of it shows us very clearly that that assumption of ours and that hope of ours has no basis. And that means that we ought to be rethinking our policy toward China.
Rethinking it along what lines, Seth Cropsey, and what are the implications of it for, among other things, naval power?
Well, the first thing is that Chinese attempts to declare, to make, use the law and military force to turn large pieces of international waters into Chinese sovereign territory should be countered. That means sending ships much more frequently to conduct freedom of navigation operations. It means working more closely with our five treaty allies in the region so that they do the same thing. And in every respect, both military, diplomatic, and economic, countering China's wrongful claims that they possess the South China Sea. They don't. It's international waters.
Seth Cropsey, you are a serious student of these matters and a thinker about strategy, and have really been distinguished by those qualities for some time. I just wonder, when you have a country that has now essentially through force of arms, they were unopposed, but nonetheless they are using the threat of force to accomplish this seizure of well, large ocean areas, certainly the shoals on which they've built these now fortified islands, they have a permanent presence. And I just wonder, to what extent does the periodic passage of an American ship, or for that matter, others of our allies, really constitute a comparable capability? Do we not need to actually have them dispossessed of this this stolen real estate?
Well, dispossession would be very helpful. I don't see that as likely in the future, but I'm sure you've heard the term used, and that is lawfare, and that's a combination of legal means, law, and warfare, that China is using to establish its claim. That claim, insofar as it's a military one, is to a bunch of man-made islands with an airstrip here and there and several guns, artillery in other places. And
missiles, those, and ports.
These are, yeah, right. these are pawns in a much larger game. And for military purposes, if there was any kind of conflict between China and the United States, those islands in military terms would be useless. It'd be gone very quickly. So, and this is not exactly secret information. Everybody knows it. The Chinese know it. So it's really a question of establishing claims, of being present in the area, of working together with allies, of making it clear that those claims are not recognized, they're not accepted, they're in violation of international law as they now are. And we're talking about a situation that exists before hostilities, and we hope is intended to deter the hostilities. So I don't see them getting out of those islands, but in military terms, they're useless.
Let me ask you, Seth, very quickly in closing. Again, you have written extensively on this, including in May Day, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy. Talk, if you would, quickly about what kind of naval capabilities we need to have in a place like the South China Sea to be able to conduct these kinds of operations and more as we need to.
We have one carrier in the region, at the very most on occasion two. We need more ships in the area, below the sea, on the sea, on the surface, and ones that are capable both of projecting power and controlling the seas. So that means everything from aircraft carriers, and if aircraft carriers are not available, then powerful surface ships. It should go without saying, but it needs to be said, that a greater submarine presence there is also required. Our capabilities are vastly superior to China's. Both we and the Chinese know that. But the Navy's decision, or the Obama administration's decision, to change the mix of U.S. ships from 50% half in Asia and half in the rest of the world to 60-40, so the 60% would be in Asia, the West Pacific, and 40% would be in the rest of the world, has little meaning so long as the Navy continues to decline, as it has under the Obama administration. So that has to be reversed.
Seth Cropsey, thank you very much for your time and this exposition on both math and lawfare. In fact, we'll talk more about lawfare with David Edesny right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all, the few, the proud, the Marines.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has in 2015 begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hello, I'm Ace Lyons. As a retired 4-star admiral who served as Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, is a special privilege for me to talk to you about an important new book just released by the Center for Security Policy, China Prepares for Conflict, and Why We Must Do the Same. The book explains that while the Obama administration has dithered over the deterioration of the Middle East and ignored Asia, China has been moving to challenge and displace the dominant role the United States has played in this region and the world since the end of World War II. I am one of 9 co-authors of this important book. The others are former Senator Jim Talent, Gordon Chang, Peter Navarro, Kevin Freeman, Bill Gertz, Frank Gaffney, Fred Flights, and Dean Chang. I explained in my chapter how China's efforts over the last 20 years to seize control of almost the entire South China Sea is an indication of new assertiveness to advance its regional dominance at the expense of the United States. I take issue with President Obama's benign neglect of the threat from China and how Beijing is building islands in the South China Sea that it plans to turn into stationary aircraft carriers to threaten freedom of navigation in this region. Like the other authors of this book, I believe the next president must act immediately to restore American leadership and its military power, both of which have been seriously undermined by the disastrous policies of President Obama. We urgently need to modernize and increase the size of our land, naval, and air forces to stand up to China and other adversaries worldwide. We also need to recognize and counter the growing cyber and intelligence threats from China. The bottom line is that our nation needs to act now. I strongly commend this important book, China Prepares for Conflict and Why We Must Do the Same. You can read it for free as an ebook on the Center's website, securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Dr. David Adesnik. He is the policy director at the Foreign Policy Initiative, having served in previous incarnations as a deputy director of the Joint Data Support Center at the U.S. Department of Defense. He has worked in Baghdad for the Defense Department as well and is a Rhodes Scholar, among many other extraordinary achievements. David, thank you so much for joining us. It's good to have you back.
Thank you for having me back.
One of the things that you've been musing about, and I think are worried about as am I, is what President Obama seems to have in mind in his last days in office with respect to, further disarming our nuclear deterrent. What's afoot as you see it, and what are the stakes?
Well, there's still a mystery to a certain extent. There's been some reporting in the Washington Post which is probably the most accurate sense that we have, but still a fair amount of uncertainty there, that it seems that advisors in the White House are cooking up what could be sort of a last-dash nuclear disarmament agenda for the administration's last several months in office, and it's specifically designed, according to the Post, to implement measures that could go around Congress that wouldn't require any sort of assent like a treaty. One would be using the UN or a UN Security Council resolution as an indirect means to ratify a test ban treaty that has never been able to get much of a chance of ratification by Congress. Another one would be an extension by 5 years of the New START treaty signed with Russia in the first couple of years of the Obama administration, basically adding 5 years so the next president, even if they had two terms, wouldn't have an opportunity to reevaluate. Another one, which is probably the least likely, is a cancellation of the program to create a new nuclear-capable cruise missile known as LRSO. And also there has been talk of cutting the nuclear modernization budget, which is, you know, just over the horizon. There's a major overhaul since we haven't put in new systems since the 1980s. So all of these are reportedly on the table.
We're talking with Dr. David Adesnik of the Foreign Policy Initiative, a man with considerable experience in the Pentagon and in the national security community more generally. And I just wanted to make sure we didn't neglect this one other thing that the administration seems to be toying with, namely a simple pronouncement that we will no longer contemplate the first use of nuclear weapons. What are you hearing about that?
Right. So that would be purely a declaratory statement. It's almost just a signal to potential adversaries and to our allies. You know, it was something that came up. Congress really called a hearing pretty quickly to respond to this because there's concern on both sides of the aisle. You actually saw seven Democratic senators send a message as well, along with a number of Republicans, actually, that included Tim Kaine, who's now the vice presidential nominee for the party. It's a move that clearly had been contemplated in the past in the nuclear posture review earlier in the administration. The sort of the conclusion was conditions are not yet right to have this no first use policy, but perhaps we could move toward those conditions. And I think the question that would come up if the administration signals it wants to do that is what makes them think we're in a better position to do it now when, of course, we have major deterioration in relations with Russia, North Korea is more truculent than ever, and we have other problems, too.
This sort of hardy perennial of the arms control community has not sat well, as I understand it, with some of our allies. Do you have any read on how they're taking it and whether, in fact, this might actually be a fresh impetus behind them considering their own nuclear deterrence?
Regrettably, I don't have a good read on the most immediate reactions to this. I don't know how far this has percolated outside of D.C., although I think embassies, especially of South Korea, Japan, and others are watching. I think the general problem is that often we rely on our nuclear deterrent as an important symbol to reassure allies. And so no first use, while it sounds good in principle, we would never want to use nuclear weapons. The question is, how does that potentially constrain us in scenarios where North Korea or someone else finds sort of provocative ways to escalate as close as possible to the nuclear threshold, but if they're confident we won't do anything and don't have a great non-nuclear response, then we'll effectively stand down, leaving South Korea, Japan, or another ally in the lurch. So that's really the logic behind why you tend to see expressions of concern about this from other allies.
David Adesnik, let me ask you about something else that you've recently been writing about, and that is that the technique of using economic instruments to wage war against jihadists that are seeking our destruction has been practiced perhaps to a degree that most of us aren't aware of, but perhaps could also be practiced much more fulsomely. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, so I've had the chance to know the author, a professor by the name of Ord Khitri, for several years, and he's produced really a first-rate book called Lawfare, sort of the use of law as a means of warfare, and it really documents the rise of this trend over the past 20 years, that it was sort of a novel response when Hamas killed an American citizen who was in Israel, and the idea was to go after Hamas's financial backers, not just trying to pick up the bomber or people who provided the bomb to the bomber. You know, sort of a doctrine we would accept in other aspects of business and life is that if you provide someone with the means to do something dangerous, you have a share of the responsibility. And the result, surprisingly, was shutting down a really quite strong Hamas financial network in this country in federal court and, you know, putting a real financial dent in its abilities.
Let me ask you about one other thing quickly. You have also been evaluating something that is getting a lot more attention at the moment because of, I guess, Donald Trump's ruminations on the question of NATO and specifically whether the member nations are picking up their fair share of the tab. What have you found, and what do you think the prospects are of NATO sort of coming undone over a failure to invest in national defense?
Well, if you know the trends that were going through 2014 continued, we would be heading toward a serious problem. So 2 years ago at the Wales NATO summit, there was a pledge that NATO countries would try to invest 2% of their GDP, their national income, in defense, and that but they'd be shooting at that target over around 10 years. That target had been mentioned earlier, hadn't been enshrined in the same official way before 2014, and so there had been terrible declines despite it. However, for the first time, 2015, we saw an end to the declines, and in 2016, a slight uptick. Certain countries, obviously, on the front line get it. Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, they're putting through numbers like a 40-50% increase or more. But, you know, the cornerstone of the alliance is the larger states, I mean, other than the United States even, that we need the UK, Germany, and France to get back to that level. And so the question is this a temporary response that they feel the pressure from Russian intimidation and they're going to be good for a couple years, or is this going to continue? Because if they don't get up to that level, which is actually still far below what they were investing during the Cold War, there could be a real question of whether those other than frontline states in the United States are committed to really defending against threats.
And as you look at this, when you hear Donald Trump essentially throwing down the gauntlet that if they don't ante up, they will not be protected by the United States. As you say, the countries certainly most immediately at risk are the ones that are doing their bit, modest though it is in the great scheme of things. How do you see this playing out, David?
Well, so as you just pointed out, the countries, you know, whether it's the Baltics or the Poles, of course, have invested as well. So the ones that are most afraid, and we'd have the problem, well, we're not going to tell the French, well, we're not going to protect you. They're not immediately the ones facing a problem or the Germans. The problem is getting them to see our Eastern European frontier with Russia as part of a broader problem that will worsen if they don't contribute. And, you know, I would argue that Trump's basic idea is that, well, we pull out if people don't do this. He misses the political value of the alliance. Actually, you know, having 27 or 28 nations speak in concert, delivering a united front to Russia is much better than having Russia pick apart and using whatever means of subversion or suborning it can to create further, you know, fissures. You know, as we saw in the run-up to the Iraq War in 2003, there are real diplomatic complications that come when the U.S. and its allies are at loggerheads. So that's one reason you don't let an alliance go. It's political as well as diplomatic. And despite the lack of spending, you know, NATO is still spending around $250 billion a year. Three of the top 10 spenders on defense are non-American countries in NATO. So we don't want to lose that. We don't want to give up the fact that there are probably 100,000 deployable troops in Europe. So sort of a temperamental, we're taking our jacks and going home, is not productive.
To say the least, especially with a Putin in the mix. David Dedesnik, thank you very much for your time today, as always, and for the good work you do at the Foreign Policy Initiative. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.